Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. It's one thing, as I do, to raise tomatoes and squash in Silver Lake within walking distance to a wine store and a library, but it's another thing entirely to raise chickens, pigs, and turkeys on an abandoned lot in inner city Oakland. Novella Carpenter gives a whole new meaning to the term urban farmer, raising organic lettuce, donating it to the Black Panthers outreach program, foraging from high-end Berkeley dumpsters for her pigs, all amidst gunfights and squabbles among street denizens. Novella grew up in rural Idaho and Washington State, the daughter of back-to-the-land hippies. She studied biology and English at the University of Washington, where she had many odd jobs, including assassin bug handler and 16-millimeter projectionist. She attended Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism and studied with Michael Pollan. Farm City, which she'll talk about tonight, is really a beautiful book. It's both a cautionary tale and a full-throated call to action. It's hilarious and moving and beautifully written and actually gave me very strange dreams. Several nights running, I think it was those rabbits. You'll hear more about those later. So without further ado, Novella Carpenter.
Thank you so much for that introduction. And I do wonder about the city ordinances, so thanks for sharing. I now know LA's ordinance for livestock. Like writing this book, it's hard to think about what to talk about. There are so many issues, you know. We have the recession happening. There's people that are, you know, really getting into urban farming. There's all these different ways of urban farming, but I thought I would just start by just talking about what I've been up to, so you just can get a flavor of the farm. This will closely follow the sort of unraveling of what happened on Ghost Town Farm, which is my little farm in Oakland. This is the farm. You all know where Oakland is, right? It's it's right across the bay from San Francisco. So it's basically, I like to say, it's like, you must have an equivalent in Los Angeles, but maybe not, but it's like the Brooklyn of the San Francisco area. It's kind of like this place where people are like, don't go over there. But of course you want to go over there because there's lots of good things about it. So this is where it is. You can see it's actually not this like giant green thing. Like I wish that was my farm. I'm always like, why can't it be bigger? It's that little tiny thing, that little corner right there. That's Ghost Town Farm. It's an abandoned lot that discovered when I first moved to into my apartment. There was a 4,500 square foot lot just next to the apartment, and I was like, this is good. This is good. So there was all these weeds and things growing there. And so I decided that I wouldn't ask permission and I would just start farming on it. So I've been doing it for 6 years now, and this is how that goes down. But you can see there's a big highway running there, and there's also the BART tracks, you know, like the metro, the subway runs right by there too. And one day I am going to take over that schoolyard. That's that big baseball field. So anyway, this is the lot. This is taken about a couple years ago, so it's just taken from my kitchen. This is kind of my view in the morning. So it's very jankety. You know, there's no Martha Stewart going on in my world. thank you. So it's like basically I found things and then I created garden beds to, you know, it was, you know, just found wood and just anything that someone gave me. You'll notice that there's lots of, they're raised beds for the most part. And it's not because of the soil. When, you know, anytime you move into a place and you're going to start farming, you should always have the soil tested. And so I did, and this lot actually came out lead free. The thing is that there's a concrete pad that it's, you know, it basically there used to be this giant apartment building there. And so that foundation is still there. So I just built the beds over that. And then every year I mulch it, so it has these wood chips. And so slowly I'm building soil, but that's kind of how that looks. So here's what happens. You go to a website, and there's this poultry website that I really like that probably some of you are a little addicted to as well. And it's called Murray McMurray Hatchery. And then the mailman comes, and then this is what you have in your living room. So cute! And they make all these noises, you know, like everybody makes a different noise. And so the like those are geese, those are little goslings and ducks and turkeys in this package, and little chicks. So cute. And then these are the chicks, some chickens that I got too. So this is kind of how I got started. I became obsessed with, well, I moved to Oakland. I was into the, you know, living in the Bay Area. I had this whole list of things why I wanted to move to California, which was like surfing and hip hop and tennis and, you know, things like that. And one of them was like kind of urban farming. Like I had heard a little bit about it and I was curious. And part of my whole, the reason why I got fascinated with doing it myself was that I would go to the Berkeley Farmers Market, and I'm sure you guys have farmers markets like this too, where you're just like, oh my God, this is like, I just paid like $30 for some soup bones. You know, you just can't believe how much money everything is. And it's great, like food should be more expensive, but you know, if you're a scrounger, you're like, what? I can't afford this. So I had this great idea, like I'll raise my own Thanksgiving turkey. So I ordered these turkeys in the mail and they came in that box like that. And then I attempted to raise them. So that's kind of how, that was at least what was going on in my brain. But what happens is it's like chickens and also bees, I keep bees as well. They are the gateway animals to urban farming madness. Like, you know, you just start with these like things that are really easy, like chickens and bees. You're like, wow, I just like throw some food and then I have eggs and then I have honey. You know, it's like the bees are totally fascinating. The chickens are totally fascinating. Like any of you guys that have chickens, chicken television, you know, you're just like watching them all day long. It's so fun. You're like, I'm going to give them a worm and see what happens. And, you know, so it's so fun. And so what happens is you start to get maybe a false sense of, you know, that your abilities. And so that's kind of what happened to me, especially with the turkeys, because the turkeys are, unlike chickens, more of a charismatic animal. And so they would leave the farm often. And so I would be, like, chasing turkeys down 27th Street, and they would fly around and just cause all kinds of drama, basically, on the farm. And the other thing about turkeys is they're really big. And the other thing is that you're going to kill it. So here's a picture of me showing some kids how to pluck a turkey. So we had done this whole workshop. And so I learned actually how to kill a turkey. And it was a really, really powerful thing to know how to do that. And I think a lot of people don't want to kill an animal. I think that's great. But for me, I felt like I'm a meat eater. I need to own up to it. I need to see what it really means to eat meat. And, you know, Thanksgiving turkey, that's like the most epic ceremonial meat that we have here in America. So that's why I decided to do turkeys. In terms of economics, total disaster. I spent so much money feeding these turkeys, and two of them, one of them died, one of them flew away, never came back. So, you know, I had this, like, one turkey. But it was, like, the best turkey ever. So, and then I had all these experiences that happened around it, too. So then I was determined to sort of, like, find out what is it that I could raise, that would be more cost effective. Now, you guys probably have seen Roger and Me. You remember the scene where he's like, yeah. And I was thinking about that the other day, and I was like, you know, that scene is weird because it's almost like we're supposed to be so horrified that this woman isn't like empowering herself to feed herself. And that's what rabbits are. They multiply like crazy. Sorry, if there's any children in the audience, cover the... I love this picture because it's kind of like hazy. It's like, what's going on? But this is one of my bucks, Simon, doing his business. And it's really cute to watch this. There's grunting involved. But anyway, we don't have to talk about it. It's okay. But then what happens, you get the little tiny babies. And then I'm like, I'm gonna eat that? Like, that's insane. Like, that is too cute. But what happens is they all have a bunch of babies, and then you have all these rabbits, and they're sort of like, you know, I keep them on my deck. It's like, you know, it's very Cuba, kind of. So you walk out onto the deck where, like, there should be, like, an umbrella and tropical drinks being served. Instead, it's like this rabbit, you know, crazy rabbit scene. And what happens is you kind of realize that, you know, the rabbits are growing up, and you are the farmer. You need to deal with them. So that's kind of what happened to me. The other thing I had on my hand is that this is a picture of me and my sister. And these are not pet rabbits, okay? These are, like, our meat rabbits. So my mom used to slaughter rabbits on our farm in Idaho, and it was part of the whole deal. You know, you ate meat, and this was the easiest thing that you could grow, and they're really easy to raise. So it's kind of part of my heritage to raise rabbits. On the other hand, so one thing that happens, well, like I said, the gateway drug. So what you just start moving toward this, like, mania. And, you know, after you have rabbits, it's kind of like you start to wonder, like, well, could I get a cow? Or if I had sheep, where would I put them? And at the same time, I started to have this feeling like, well, one of the things I tried to do was make this, like, really sustainable. Like the garden, we found everything, and all of those, you know, containers were made out of things we found. We had started, my boyfriend and I, when I say we had started to notice that, we had discovered dumpster diving, basically. So what happened was, but it wasn't for us. I mean, you know, I still do dumpster dive for myself. I enjoy it. But what I found out was, like, oh my God, the dumpsters are full of stuff that animals would like to eat as well. And so the rabbits, you know, there's this, like, really fancy grocery store where everything, this is in Berkeley, of course, where everything's organic. Like, there's no GMO product in the entire store. And they have this amazing dumpster that's just filled with lettuce, like, you know, just the outer leaves of the lettuce that they didn't want to sell. And so we were feeding the rabbits that and dumpstered baguettes and things like that. And in our sort of quest to feed these, you know, these different animals, the chickens got involved too. They love melons and other things. We were like, you know, there's enough food in here to feed a pig. And then we just kind of said it and laughed. And then, you know, we would start having dreams about the pigs and stuff. And so we went to a swine auction, and we got two pigs. So here's a picture of the backyard. This is what a lot of people want to know. Like, what does the backyard look like? So it's not the entire backyard, but so this is, you can kind of see the pigs back there. I like how I'm wearing flip-flops. That's like, you know, you're out, like, hanging out with pigs. You love wearing flip-flops. But I thought I would read this like little section of the book just to give a flavor for what's going on in my brain. So these pigs, at this point, they're about a month old. So we went to the swine auction in April. And they're really small, and we fit them in the back of our station wagon. And then this is what happened when we got home. Back in the ghetto, I herded the pigs into their new home. It was just getting dark. The air felt heavy, but it wasn't raining. That morning, in anticipation of the piglets, I had enhanced the chicken area with a bucket filled with water and a feeding trough made from the same metal wash tub I had once used to dip and pluck Harold the turkey. I had also tipped a barrel sideways, which you can see, with the idea that they would sleep in it. The chickens had walked into the barrel and pecked at the metal trough. They seemed confused. Safely behind the closed gate of their yard, the pigs seemed mildly curious, but far from the geniuses stomping out Morse code with their cloven feet, thank God. They ran around kicking up sawdust as they had in the ring a few hours ago. The chickens came down from their roost to investigate their new house guests. The piglets sniffed at the chickens, which caused a panic, and the chickens retreated back to the chicken house for the night. The pigs were both red Duroks. Duroks, sometimes called Jersey Reds, are known for quality fat production. These pigs had, even in their young age, the classic arched backs that one often sees in profile on meat company labels. They had curly tails, but it was not a tight curl. And I noticed later that they wagged them when they were happy with a certain food item, or the sun was shining just right, or I was scratching their backs with a stick. The tails then did convey emotion. As they checked out their surroundings, they made quiet grunting sounds. I wondered if the city noises, a police helicopter circling the hood, someone yelling at the junkyard dogs next door, would be a shock to their system. They had, after all, lived in deep country, all trees and pastures. But if they were disturbed by the city's smells and sounds, they made no sign of it. Pigs, I was glad to see, are not very sensitive. Bill and I looked at the pigs newly installed in their pen as they nosed around the corner of their area. Then they stood in front of their gate and smiled up at us expectantly. We read their minds. Where's the pig chow? On cue, we jumped in the car and raced over to Chinatown. That night, for the first time ever, Bill and I threw open the dumpsters with our hearts and minds. Will they eat, we wondered, these soggy pieces of Chinese donut? I discovered, yes. These chunks of leftover duck from the restaurant window in which everything exudes a steady flow of oil, including the duck head? Yes. Wontons and dumplings covered with somehow frosting? Yes. Grapes, watermelon, egg-fried rice? Yes, yes, yes. Bill and I anxiously unloaded our two buckets of slop from the car. We'd never collected such a disgusting assortment of salty and sweet meat and vegetable. But pigs, I had heard, were omnivorous, and so we were respecting that. When we walked through the gate to the backyard, we were greeted by two grunts, one deep and demanding, the other soft, questioning. I hefted a bucket full of Chinatown into the metal washtub trough. The pigs began feeding before the second bucket was empty, so I ended up pouring a load of grapes and wontons over their heads and watching it all bounce off their shoulders and land on the straw-strewn ground. Their focus was amazing. While they ate, the pigs let out small sighs of approval. Their lip smacking was audible. At times, they would stop chewing and simply suck up the juices from the trough through their nostrils. Yeah. They were the best dinner guests ever. The pigs stopped eating for a moment and gazed up at us. Their mouths moved continuously. Their chins were smeared with frosting and grease. Now that I thought about it, these pigs had probably never had food like this before. They had probably only had their mother's milk, a few handfuls of pig chow, and maybe a rotten animal. I mean, apple. And maybe a rotten animal, too. God. Now they were eating Chinese, like good urban pigs. So that's just that. Thank you. So that was the pigs. And then, oh my God. Yeah, they got that big. That is so scary. I look at this picture and I'm like, run. Like, girl, you're crazy. And I'm still wearing the flip-flops. That is so scary. It was funny because the, you know how like there's that gate, you know, that you open and close to like let the pigs out? At the end of their time with us, the thing had gotten so full that you actually had to step up. You'd be like, you know, entering into their little pen. It was it was just like a pile of rotting compost and pig poo. It was gross. And it also felt like they might, if I fell, they would eat me. So a lot of people are like, how could you do it? And I'm like, you know what? Look at this picture. Like, they were waiting for me to fall so they could just, like, gobble me up. And I just love their butts. Like, it's just, like, just huge butts. So that was how that happened. So, yeah, I know. But don't they look kind of hopeful in these pictures? I mean, the expression on their face is, like, kind of like, what? The next thing. Yeah, so one of the delights of having the pigs was that I would go to these, I would go dumpster dive at these really high-end restaurants, as Louise said, and at one point I got caught in the dumpster. Like, well, it happened a couple different times. I would constantly be getting caught in the dumpster, and then I would have to explain what I was doing, because people are like, what, you're pulling chicken carcasses out of the dumpster? And then I'd be like, I have two pigs. And then they'd be like, you're even weirder than we thought. But then they'd be like, go ahead, whatever. And then I met this chef who then somehow agreed to teach me how to make salumi. So he was this, had been a trained Italian butcher, and routinely made, you know, all kinds of different stuff, salami and coppa and pancetta and prosciutto. And so he took me under his wing, thank God, Because what was I going to do with all this meat? You know, later I think about it. I mean, those pigs are huge. Like, I would have turned into one of those pigs if I ate all that meat, you know, in one sitting. Because, you know, it's like you would just have, like, these pork chops from hell. I mean, they were really delicious, but, you know, you would get fat. And so the idea was like, oh, my God, if I could dry cure, if I could salt cure a lot of this meat, then I would have it over a period of a year instead of just eating it all at once. So that's what happened. And Evan and I probably can talk about that some more because those were some really funny stories. And I want to hear if she ever caught someone in her dumpster, what she would say about it. So anyway, I got really lucky on that end. So this isn't in the book, but after my pig experience, I started to feel a little bit like the witch in Hansel and Gretel, where I was like constantly, every single animal, I was like, when can I eat you? When can I eat you? And like, that's messed up. So even I realized that that's messed up. And so, and you know, I'm a Capricorn, so I was like, goats, I love goats. And so I bought a pregnant Nigerian dwarf goat. And then she had this beautiful baby, and another one as well. And so now I have a little flock of goats. I know, she's so cute and soft. And so they are milk goats, and I milk them in the mornings, and I make cheese and yogurt and all kinds of things like that. And I just, there's something about the goats that are, you know, unlike the pigs, which, let's face it, at the end of their life, they were monsters that scared me. The goats are the kind of thing that I come home from work after a bad day, and I'll just be like, go hang out with the goats, and there's little baby ones now, and they'll come and snuggle with me, and then everything's fine. You know, I just have goat poo on my pants and goat hair everywhere, but it's like, it just helps me get through life. And that's kind of what I was thinking about, why, I mean, because a lot of times I have to explain myself, like, why are you doing this? And I feel like one of the things, the problems with our modern society is that we're constantly just like looking at little Blackberries and computers and stuff, and we never have this experience with this like living thing. Like sometimes our lives are really like Blade Runner kind of, everything's dead, and we're lucky if we find something that is actually real. And so for me, that's why I love having the animals. It just kind of grounds me in this way, and it really makes me happy. But I also do it for food reasons, too. You know, the meat that I have, that I raise, the rabbit meat, is amazingly delicious. The milk from these goats the taste is incredible. The chicken eggs are, as you chicken owners know, are amazing. And so it's like this thing that just, like, keeps going on. You know, you have something new to learn about, you're grounded, you're connected to nature, and then you get to eat delicious food. And it doesn't, I mean, you know, you don't, it depends, but if you dumpster dive, you can save a lot of money. So do that. So that's kind of my talk. I was thinking that Evan and I should talk about lots of things, but one of them is a lot of people don't have property. They don't have a backyard, or they live in an apartment. So this is my friend Patrick that lives in Portland and started an egg collective, so they share these chickens together, and I think that's a really cool model. I also wanted to talk about like the history of urban farming. A lot of people are like, didn't urban farming really start in, like, you know, 1991? Or, you know, everyone's trying to put it like a date on it. This book is from the 70s, The Integral Urban House, which is an amazing house in Berkeley. It doesn't exist anymore, but they were doing all the same things as I do. You know, they have rabbits, and they have this, like, composting toilet. They actually have a tilapia farm, which I haven't gotten there yet. And they're raising chickens, and it's all in the city. And the idea is that the city is this really dense place, and so why not grow our food and, you know, divert the waste stream into growing stuff? And of course, there's the Victory Gardens, and then, you know, basically urban farming has been around for a long time. And just to end on a funny story is you know, people send me stuff all the time. They're like, hey, did you ever hear about this or that? Or, you know, the other night I was watching Sanford and Son. Has anyone watched that lately? Julio has a goat. He brings his goat, and Fred Sanford's always like, go milk your goat. And so, like, that was, like, part of, like, that could be a character in a television show, is this urban farmer guy. But, you know, we never called it urban farming or whatever. But I guess there was a British sitcom, too, that was called The Good Life. And did anyone ever watch that? That is so funny. It's this guy in London who quits his corporate job and becomes a farmer in the city. And he has these neighbors that he hates, and they're always, like, making fun of him. Anyway, so it's really funny. I just watched a clip of that. So all I'm saying is it's been around for a long time. It will continue to be around. It's a trend right now. But I would like to make it more of like something that we just integrate animals and vegetables into our lives and make it have so we can have a connection. I mean, I'm not saying like throw away your BlackBerry because, you know, everybody loves their BlackBerry. But, you know, we can have both. And that's like the beauty of the modern world. So anyway, those are that's my deep thought. So thanks. And let's talk, Evan.
Shot of the goats and the little chickens. I don't know if you could tell, but those are on the stairs that go up to Novella's apartment because they live upstairs.
And I just want to interject because I didn't get to properly introduce Evan, who most of you probably already know.
Cookbook author, a chef, and owner of the beloved Angeli Cafe, one of LA's great restaurants, a slow food advocate, and the host of Good Food on KCRW. So please welcome.
Thank you. So I just wanted to tell you how I met Novella about 3 years ago at the Taste 3 conference, which was sort of like a mini food TED conference up at the Copia, which unfortunately doesn't exist anymore. And I heard her give a talk much like the one she just gave, and I just said, oh my God, I love this woman. And what I loved about her was the lack of pretense and the grittiness, because when you are involved in sort of a central place in around a lot of people like to grow things and who garden and want to make jam, here it can get a little precious sometimes, and you can go visit people's, you know, backyards and you think, I could never do that, and you know, then you realize that they pay people to do that, to make it really fabulous and beautiful. So when I was at Slow Food Nation up in San Francisco, I called Novella and I said, I'm coming. Can I come by and see the farm? So she said, sure. So I took the subway over to Oakland, and Novella picked me up in her biodiesel Mercedes. And let me describe the car. All the interior panels are basically ripped away from the walls,
right,
and there are these huge dirt clods on
the
floor.
That was poo. That was poo. Okay.
And there's straw everywhere.
Right.
And so it was like, okay, I'm now entering into this alternative universe. And when I got to the farm and I saw her the lot. It made me feel a lot better because it's very similar to what I do in my yard, and I always think that people think I'm sort of like the white trash of the neighborhood.
Right.
Because I use a lot of found objects. But what I was struck with was that the desire in Novella to grow things and learn about making her own food and accepting what that would entail required a great deal of intelligence, commitment, and with nothing extraneous, like the No Martha Stewart, no need to spend a lot of additional energy to pretty things up or make straight rows, and I think a lot of us who want to take this next step get stuck in that place of where it should be beautiful, and it should just be. I don't think it has to be beautiful.
Yeah.
So, Novella, let's talk just for a second. How many people have already read the book? Okay, you all have to. I mean, it is such a great read, hilarious and moving, and you meet an amazing cast of characters. Talk a little bit about your neighborhood, where you live, who lives on your street, who your neighbors are.
Right. Well, I didn't talk about that too much in my. You know, intro thing, but the neighborhood is called Ghost Town. That's the local speak for my neighborhood. And the reason it's called Ghost Town is that approximately half of the buildings are totally abandoned. Houses are shuttered. People don't live there. There's kind of a, you know, a wind that starts blowing at night. And the crack zombies come out kind of place. I'm sure you have places like that here in LA too. But so part of that experience is that it's great for urban farming because you can take over a lot for 6 years and nobody stops you. At the same time, you have, you know, like just yesterday, I witnessed a fight, you know, so there's constantly, you know, major tension and battle going on. The other thing is that I get to see kids eating Fritos for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And that disturbs me greatly. And I don't want to be like, because I eat Fritos too, but I'm trying to eat some salad at the same time. So then I try to invite people who are open to those things into the garden. And I have, basically a group of people that come in to harvest vegetables. And people are always like, oh my God, you let people take your vegetables? I'm like, I'm a squatter. I took the land. You know, like, what the hell right do I have to tell people not to eat stuff? Especially the New Yorkers. They're always like, what? Someone took your carrots? Like I should call the police or something. I'm like, what are you talking about? And I actually am incredibly satisfied when I look out into my lot and from my kitchen while I'm drinking coffee and I see someone picking apples. I mean, I'm just like, yes, someone ate some good produce today in my neighborhood. So I'm very driven by that. I think it's wrong that there's so much social inequity. Thank you. In the world, and so by gardening, I try to sort of like do. I'm doing the thing that I can do. You know what I mean? I can't donate money, and I can't like go volunteer someplace. And so, so I just grow food, and I see who shows up to eat it.
Are most of the other urban farmers that you know in Oakland farming in neighborhoods similar to yours?
Yeah, most of them are. It's definitely mixed. Most of the urban farmers I know are part of a nonprofit, which is great. We need those nonprofits, you know, because they have a structure and they employ people and there's like rules and stuff, which I don't have. But yeah, they're usually in places that are either, well, not necessarily, but no, definitely there's not like big urban farms in Berkeley, for instance, where people are better off.
Because, you know, I just try and imagine after I came back from your house, and and I saw the goats. Would you know how all of our houses that are next to each other? There's that narrow space in between everybody's yard, and usually you can't grow anything there because it's very narrow. There's not very much dirt, and the sun comes in at a really strange odd angle because of the height of the house walls. But the goats just, like, yeah, love it. They just run up and down. And so I'm thinking to myself, gosh, maybe I could put goats back there. But, you know, I just know that that would last a day before neighbors would, you know, tar me and feather me. And
oh, yeah, you'd be busted.
You'd be totally busted. So, yeah. I mean, like, hearing those rules. Mm-hmm. So do you think that a lot of urban farmers just go ahead and do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Chicken people definitely do, right?
Chicken people
those of you who have chickens.
Well, you know what it really is? It's all about your relationships with your neighbors. You know, because nobody, like the 25 feet from your house chicken rule, I mean, that is only going to be enforced if your neighbor calls and your neighbor hates you for some reason, you know? And that happens all the time. Like, people hate their neighbors. It's a horrible thing. I think some of my neighbors may find me to be amusing, but they don't hate me.
But you also are in a great situation because your neighbors are... Talk about your neighbors. Because your neighbors come from different ethnic groups who are not that far removed from farming.
So that's right. So, like, the thing about Ghost Town, about that neighborhood, is that it's totally, like, all these different immigrant groups that just showed up and are living together in this, like, mashup. So there's Yemeni people. There's people from Somalia. Many of my neighbors are Vietnamese because there's a Buddhist monastery across the street. So there's, like, these monks in these robes that come out and walk around the garden. And I'm like, yeah, the big monk's out. You know, and so there is a culture that we don't have in America, or we've forgotten that urban farming has been going on for a really long time. And in third world countries like Vietnam, it is normal. I was just talking to a woman who lives in Saigon. It's normal to see a pig peeking out of a backyard in downtown Saigon. Like, it is just what people do. It's the same in India. People keep chickens and all kinds of different livestock in the city. So we can learn a lot from these third world countries, and that luckily we're, you know, we have these immigrants that come to America and are part of the dialogue. And a lot of, I should point out, a lot of those ordinances are totally anti-immigrant. They're like, oh, well, we don't want any Mexican people coming into our neighborhood and raising roosters. And so they make these ordinances. So then you can't have those people live there. So it's this really, like, it's a subtle kind of racism. And for me, it's great. I love the fact that, for instance, the liquor store owner, Mosed, goes by Moses. I'm always like, what the hell? Moses? That's not a Muslim name. But anyway, he, and why is he running a liquor store? I don't know. But one of the delicious ironies of urban life. But he is a former goat herd farmer, and so I didn't know that. And of course, you never know these secret lives that people have until you show up with a goat, and you're like, hey, can you help me kill this goat? But so, yeah, he's been really great, and I bring goats over and ask him questions. And, you know, so there's this huge amount of knowledge that people have.
Well, didn't he help you slaughter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we had this one male goat that we had to get rid of. He was becoming aggressive with the babies. Did you meet Bilbo?
I don't think so.
Bilbo. Anyway, so we were like gonna go buy. Well, here's what happened. Well, and you'll read it if you read the book. You'll read the book. And I had a really bad experience with a slaughterhouse with the pigs, and so I was a little hesitant. And I had this goat that I needed to have killed. And so I was gonna drive to Stockton, which is, you know, like 60 miles away, and it was gonna be this whole ordeal. And I was freaking out about it. And I was like, Bill, go buy some beer. So Bill went to go buy beer. And he went to the Yemeni market, and he's, like, talking to Moses, and he's like, yeah, we're going to go kill our goat tomorrow. And then Moses is like, what? And then it's, like, every guy in the store, like, because they all live in the house apartments above. Bill was like, I swear. It was, like, all of a sudden there was, like, a bunch of guys, like, peeking their head around. There's a goat. There's a goat. There's a goat. And like a bad racist Disney movie. And then Moses was, like, totally offended. He was like, you're going to take this goat to some place you don't even know? He's like, I will kill the goat. And it was, like, a man thing, too. It was, like, a bromance where, like, I was like, cool, my goat, right? So, because Bill doesn't have anything to do with the goats. And so in the morning I go over, and I'm like, hey, Moses, do you really want to do this? And he's like, you know, let me get my knives. And he goes and, like, gets his knives, and he's totally dressed in, like, a dress suit and pants, like, really nice clothes. His wife comes. She's in the full hijab. His daughter comes, little tiny daughter comes to watch this goat thing, and I'm just like, oh, my God. And Bill and I had built this whole, like, elaborate, like, goat-killing area right in the middle of the garden, you know, like, right. I mean, it's like MLK. It's like a major thoroughfare. Like, people are driving by constantly, and Moses looks at that and is just like, oh, you guys are idiots. No, we're not going to do it right here. And so we went, oh, we're like, okay, let's go in the backyard. And so, I mean, thank God for him. I mean, we're just fools. And it was amazing. He did the whole ceremony. She sang this song, and it was amazing. I was, like, nearly crying, and also because I was upset because of the goat, you know, but I needed to take care of him. And it was really fast, and it was funny because he wouldn't let me do it. He was just like, you know, come here, Bill, come here, Bill. And Bill is, like, a little squeamish, and Bill's all like, rrr. And Moses, I remember at one point, looks at me and is like, what the hell? Like, what is up with your man here? And so I'm like, jumped on the goat, you know, and held him down. And so there was a cultural moment there that we shared.
And then did they help you cook the goat? Did they give you a Yemeni recipe?
No, there was no Yemeni recipe. He was basically like, we hung the goat up and skinned it and cleaned it and stuff. And then I was like, hey, let me give you, like, a leg. Who has, like, does Emily Post have a rule about this? Like, I'm like, what am I supposed to do? And so I offered him some meat. He was just like, no, no, no. And I don't know if he was, like, thought that was gross or whatever. And I actually had friends. We killed the goat, and the idea was we were going to have this fundraiser. I run a biodiesel station with some other women. We really needed some money. And so we were going to sell these goat tacos. And so I had somehow convinced a chef from Chez Panisse to come and... Yeah.
This is the whole subtext, too.
Totally.
This is all, yes, this is in Oakland and Ghost Town, but right across the bay.
Yeah, right next door, really, is Berkeley. And there's like, these people are crazy. They want to, you know, and I was totally like embarrassed. I'm like, oh, I'm such a loser. I'm just like a poor person. And the chefs in the back, as you know, are awesome people. They don't, you know, they're just like, you killed a goat. Cool, let's make tacos. And so, oh my God. And this goat was 5 years old, P.S. Like, this was an old, fat, you know, not really appetizing goat. And I was like, oh man, Jerome, good luck with this one. And we gave him the meat. We actually had this whole like butchery session in the guest room, which I don't want to even talk about. But, you know, because we let the meat rest. We had to let the meat rest and then we had to butcher. Anyway, it was just like really weird. And so then Jerome cooked it, like slow cooked it, like braised it, and just kept skimmed all the fat off and just kept it going. And it was like, it was the best thing ever. It was like with these peppers, and so it had this like smoky flavor. Oh my God, Bilbo was delicious. And so, but then the worst thing is like I forgot in the, you know, kind of craziness of a big meat slaughter, I forgot to invite Moses to that. Well, because the party was at this brewery, you know, so then it was like this awkward thing. Anyway, so then now I see Moses and he's always like, hey, you owe me a goat. And I'm like, yeah, I'll get you one next time. But anyway, I bring him honey and stuff. It's fine. It's fine. Actually, the other day he brought a rooster and fattened it in the garden for a couple days.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm like, it's
have
good
you
thing.
Done anything with snails?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, I just wrote something for Food and Wine about that. Well, you know, if you ever read, like, I know, it's crazy. Like, you know the economy is bad is when the Food and Wine calls me, and they're like, yeah. I know. I was like, yes. I was like, how about snails? And I was just like, thought she would just say, no way. And she was like, cool, tell me more. Yeah, but the snails, you know, if you ever read any Fergus Henderson, he has this, like, great nose to tail. He has a recipe that's, like, bib lettuce with snails because it's, like, what they eat, you know? And I'm all about revenge. And so I'll eat a snail any day of the week. You have to pull them out and fatten them and put them off in a place where they can kind of like get rid of all the yucky
stuff.
Purge, yes, dear, and fatten.
Purge and fatten.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like many of us spend way too much money to do. Okay, let's talk about this whole slaughtering thing. I would imagine that, I mean, once people read the book, I'm sure, or read your blog, and they've been following you, I'm sure it's one of the most fascinating parts for them. How much did you learn via the internet and books, mm-hmm. reading, versus being mentored?
Yeah.
And how did you find your mentors?
Basically what it is, it's like that same thing I was talking about, kind of like the robo-hippie thing where you've got your BlackBerry, but then you have your goat, you're walking your goat, and you're like looking at your BlackBerry. And this, it's the same thing with the animal husbandry, because like the thing is like my parents, sadly, they had no internet, and so they depended on the Whole Earth catalog, which was spotty, and I love it, but, you know, kind of like some details are missing, you know what I'm saying? And so you can kind of go astray, and the thing about the internet is you can look up, you can watch a YouTube video, which is how I learned how to slaughter rabbits. I was like, what is the best way? What is the easiest, fastest, most humane way to kill a rabbit? And so I just watched a YouTube video.
And you did it on your own by yourself?
Yep, and then I did it on my own. And, you know, my mom was all like, yeah, I hit him with a hammer. Or, you know, she has some, like, crazy shit she was doing. And I was just like, I'm not going to bash their heads in. Like, that's wrong. So I gently break their necks. which somehow seems better than bashing. I don't want to bash anything. And so a lot of that was a lot of what I learned for slaughtering. I mean, the turkey was the same way. I had this great book, The Encyclopedia of Country Living, which was actually a book that my mom had. That is a great book for anybody that's interested in urban farming, because there's so many things that you can that apply to this country living thing. And I remember laughing at some of the pictures because I found the book. I used to work for the publishing company that published the encyclopedia. And I remember laughing in my cubicle in Seattle, like at the picture of like, you know, here's how you kill a pig. I was like, ha, who would ever need to know how to do that? You know, like, And, you know.
So you didn't have, the fact that you grew up in Idaho with Back to the Landers, hapless Back to the Landers.
Right.
And how long were you out there?
They only did the Back to the Land thing for about 5 years.
And how old were you?
So I was five when we left. Yeah.
And did you pretty much stuff that down somewhere for years? Or did you have a longing that came out first in growing tomatoes and lettuce?
Mm-hmm. Well, my mom had she likes to call herself the proto-urban farmer or something. But she had a big garden. We lived in a rural town, but we lived in downtown Shelton. But, you know, I'm like, Mom, it's population 7,000. That's not urban, you know. And she had us garden, do a lot of gardening stuff. And I do remember the rabbits. I do remember my mom showing us when we were kids about slaughtering rabbits. But I think there's almost something in the DNA. I mean, because we left so, you know, I was so young. I didn't know any of these things. But my sister is doing similar things. She lives in France now. She's married to a French guy. And she's doing similar things. And she doesn't, you know, we didn't learn necessarily from my mom, but it's just that impetus. It's that DIY spirit where you really do want to do something yourself. And we just happen to have better tools now to actually make it work in a way that works.
So since DIY is such a huge, I mean, it's huge now, craft and and just sort of the greater respect people are giving to things that you make yourself with your hands, and young people are fascinated with it and going at it with so much knowledge at their fingertips through the internet.
Yeah.
Are you giving classes?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I realized is I was like, God, you know, I really could have used something besides YouTube videos. You know, it would be nice to actually have somebody come over. And one thing I started doing was I was shocked that people at Chez Panisse, chefs, have never killed an animal before. And I think that if you are a chef and you're constantly dealing with meat and you're the person that's deciding which cut of meat to use, or like, are we going to throw this whole thing away or whatever after we take one little piece of it off, then I think that's weird, you know, like you should have kind of a sense of what it means. And so I actually had Jerome and a couple other guys from Chez Panisse come, and I showed them how to kill a rabbit. And then since then I've had other people, I've had classes come and do turkey slaughters or chicken slaughters. And it's funny because there's a huge urge for it now, because I mean, part of it is like Michael Pollan has sort of informed us about these things. And I think that a lot of people are just like, you know, I'll have people like grab me and like take me off into a corner and be like, I know this is weird, but next time you kill a rabbit, can I come over? And I'm like, of course. Yeah, it's not weird. Like everybody asks me that. And so now I've started teaching classes about how to do it, just because I think it's a good idea. Like, here's my best practices. I'm always open to hearing different ways that people do things. And developing that is, I think, really important. So I think classes are good. And then I also have there's a woman who teaches, she actually did a brain tanning class at my farm, and she's this crazy primitive lady. Like, she's like, wears buckskin and, you know, can make a fire with sticks. And I'm just like, wow, you know, cause like that's the other side of my family, is my mom was really into this domestication thing and, you know, raising animals and all this stuff. My dad is more like this wild man. And so I have that in me where I'm just like fascinated with this thing. Like, I'm like, I can make fire with sticks. Anyway, she's coming, and we're going to teach a class together. But she has these special methods for killing using primitive instruments.
What is brain tanning?
Oh, brain tanning is when you take the hide of an animal and you actually you cure it with its brain. It's like a Davy Crockett thing. I remember reading about it. You know, in some Davy Crockett book, but basically a deer has enough brain to tan its own hide. So it makes it soft and supple, and that's why leather that you brain tan yourself is, like, amazingly soft, like, suede-like, whereas, like, leather that you buy at the store that's been made with chemicals doesn't have that same, like, amazing quality.
So let's talk about...
That was a tangent. We're really sorry about that.
There's just so much...
Wait, I have a question for you. What would you do if you found someone in your dumpster? Have you ever found anyone in your dumpster?
No. Well, I mean, I find people in my dumpster taking all the bottles and cans to the point of where we no longer have a dumpster for bottles and cans.
Oh.
We just put them out.
Right.
In crates.
Yeah.
And then people come and take the crates.
Mm-hmm. Because there's but, a whole... I've done that too. Oh, God.
Yeah. But which is really a drag because they don't make those crates so much anymore. Now they're using cardboard for everything. So if you have milk crates, you should hang on to those. Those are...
Really?
Like rare, yes.
Oh, wow.
We used to have hundreds of them. Now we have like five.
Wow.
And that's a serious catering equipment.
But there's that thing that says like there you'll be fined $10,000 or something. I have one on my bike. I think that's so awesome. I'll like ride my bike around. I'm like, $10,000 fine.
I think that's like the mattress tag.
Yeah, it's not. I know. Who's like, what is it? The milk police are like driving around? I don't know.
Do you see yourself staying at this place in Oakland for a really long time? Let's say that Farm City crawled up the bestseller charts and you found yourself with a little wadlet of cash.
Wadlet, yeah.
What would you do? Would you want to live somewhere a little more pastoral? Would you want to have a...
Yeah, well, I know. I have this thing that's called, like, it's like a ghetto farm fantasy. You guys know what a ghetto mansion fantasy is? It's like you make it as a rap star, and then you, like, build this mansion in the ghetto, and then you have to have, like, this gate. And so I have this fantasy that if I, and this will never happen, but if I ever get my wadlet, I'm going to just, like, go buy crazy amounts of land in downtown Oakland, and I'm going to have this huge farm that'll be, like, a demonstration farm. So it'll be, like, all the kids from the neighborhood can come, and we'll do school tours, and it'll be all best practices, you know, so it'll be like in this, you know, here's what you should raise if you want meat. Here's what you should raise if
you
want.
You could have your tilapia farm.
Yeah, I could have my tilapia farm. I could have Will Allen come out, the famous urban farmer, come out and like give me a talk.
An amazing man.
Yeah, yeah. So that's like my fantasy. I would love to do that. And I would love to start an orchard. You know, I mean, I'm sad. As a squatter, I mean, I've planted so many fruit trees that I know one day during my lifetime, I'm going to watch those be bulldozed. And I know you guys had that happen at the farm in, and that is a horrifying, horrifying thought. But at the same time, it's like, you know what? We have to live life. You know, we have to plant stuff and we have to plant trees right now. And so I don't feel like, you know, I feel like land ownership is a good thing because then you feel secure, but at the same time, it's all a ruse, right? Like, nothing is ever secure in life anyway. So, in some ways, having a squat farm has kept me really honest, too, you know? Because you're just like, I'm doing what I can do right now, you know?
Okay, let's talk about salumi.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you toss off these sentences like, and I met the chef, and he was an Italian master Italian butcher, and and he took me under his wing.
Yeah.
You didn't go door to door looking for one?
Well, what happened was, well, you know, we were feeding the pigs, and they were really hungry. And so I started, what I noticed is that they preferred cooked food, right? And so, like, I started cooking for the pigs every once in a while. And then I say this in the book, but like Bill and I were the pigs' bitches. Like, we basically, these pigs took over our lives. Like, and we would start thinking like pigs, you know? We would just see, like, Bill would be like walking by at McDonald's and he'd see a hamburger in the garbage and he would grab it. And passersby would be like, oh my God, sick, you know?
Tell them the story about the Chinatown fish guts.
No. They have to read about that.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was gross.
Okay, so have an incentive.
Yeah. It was gross, the things we did to feed the pigs. And so I found myself cooking for them, and I would be like, I wonder if they like miso. And then I'd put bread, and then I'd put like nasty stuff I found. I'd be cooking in this pot. And then I started to really like resent the pigs. And so then... As you would. I mean, it's gross. And then I would, like, accidentally scald them because it was too warm when I put it down. You know, stupid stuff that I did. And but they did love cooked food. And so then I was like, wait a minute, restaurants. You know, and so we started going to these, like, restaurants. And I tried to pick, like, the really nice restaurants because I figured, you know, it's, like, cleaner for us. It's cleaner for the pigs. It's organic. One of the dumpsters we went to was this restaurant, Ecolo. And the chef had been a forager for Chez Panisse, and he had done the whole Dario Cecchini butchery thing.
This is a master butcher, a master Tuscan butcher. He's very, very famous for singing opera, quoting Dante when you walk into his butcher shop in Ponzano in the heart of Chianti.
Right. So he's this. So this guy has done these things, and he learned how to make prosciutto, which nobody in America makes bone-in prosciutto anymore. It's just like this crazy thing. It takes 2 years before you even know if it's good. So this guy is really out there. And how I found him is that I kept getting caught in the dumpster. I would be like, you know, taking the chicken carcasses out, and the pigs would be like so excited. They love the food from Eccolo. And then I realized, you know, the pigs were really eating better than me at that point too, which I sort of resented them for too. But every time I would get caught, they would always be like, "You should really go talk to Chris." And so then I was like, "Okay, I'm gonna go talk to Chris." And so I went to the front of the house like a moron, probably right at dinner at lunchtime, you know. And I'm like, "Hey, I'm here to talk to the chef." And I was like wearing dirty clothes, and I just like I don't know what I was thinking. I was really desperate. There was no way I was going to learn how to make salami on my own. There was no way. And so Chris came out and he was annoyed that who is this crazy lady? And I was like, "I have pigs in downtown Oakland." And we started talking. And then he was like, "I don't know, you know," he liked me and I liked him. And so we had kind of a meeting of the minds, and I tried to bribe him. I was like, "I'll give you one prosciutto leg," you know, like one of the pig's legs. This is like, he hadn't even seen the pigs. Plus that I'm feeding him dumpster food. He's like, "Oh my God." And you know, later he told me, he was like, "I was so annoyed that day." Cause like, you know, you just like, nobody comes to the front of the house to like sell something, you know, it's just like not done. But then he grew to love me.
When you first arrived with the meat.
Yeah.
What was his reaction?
I showed up with our biggest pig. The smaller one, the girl, I kept, and I did a whole American style butcher with. I had this other guy like cut her up into pork chops. And then I took Big Guy. So Big Guy was like the biggest pig. He was like, he had to be 300 pounds. And he was in the back of our station wagon because that's how I went to pick him up. And I don't know what I was thinking when I went to go pick up the pig. I had this idea about burlap. I don't know, burlap and pigs, you know? And so I brought this burlap sack that I wrapped the pig in, you know, and then ice, you know, because I wanted to keep it cool because, you know, I was obsessed with, like, keeping the meat cool, which later I figured out, like, nobody even cares about that, you know, like, whatever, no refrigeration needed. But so I showed up with this pig, and I was like, "Chris, oh, my God, I don't know, what do you think?" And, you know, it was like showing someone your, you know, hugest project you've ever had. And he had never seen the pigs live, and he was like, "Holy crap, that's a big pig." And then I was like, "Yeah." And I mean, you know, really, the thing had a huge ass, like, which is great because that's the prosciutto leg, right? That is what is going to become prosciutto. And Chris was a master. I mean, he put the pig up on the thing, we dusted off the burlap, and then he just started deconstructing this pig, and it was like watching dance. I mean, he had just the movements that he did, and everything just like came apart like naturally. It wasn't like he had to get some skill saw out and like, you know, cut something like horrible part. It was like Italian butchery is using all the way that the pig fits together. So it was a beautiful thing to watch, and I felt like so privileged and so honored that he was taking this time.
And how long was it before you got to eat your first piece of cured meat?
Well, what was interesting, so the salamis, those were only 3 months, and so those were ready, and so we ate those, and then the coppa and the pancetta came later, and you know, so it was all those different things. We
and
made
how delicious
lardo.
Was it?
It was amazing. It was so good. I mean, I'm always like, it's the best I ever had, but it really was. It was really, really good. And of course, he like shared his salami recipes, which is like, that's amazing.
Deep.
Of
that's
course,
deep.
I lost him, so I have no idea now. I'm like, thanks, Chris. But not that I'm going to ever do that again, you know, because it was a lot of work, and it's just intense, and now I have massive respect for people that can do that kind of thing. And then the prosciuttos were not ready for 18 months. So it was funny because I turned my book in, and then it took that long for the book to actually, but the day it came out into the bookstores, that was the day that the prosciuttos were ready.
That's so perfect.
I know, it was so perfect. And Chris did this thing, which is totally fascinating, which is to check on prosciuttos, the old style is that you get this horse bone. It's like a whittled horse bone, and then you stick it into the ham and you smell it. And that's how you know that the prosciutto's done. And so Chris sent me this email. He's like, "Novella, I don't know how to say this, but I stuck my horse bone into your hams." And they smell delicious. And I'm like, you are a sick man.
You should frame that.
I know. I should. I should print it out and frame it. But so Chris is really funny, and we had so many good times. And so what we did is we had a book release party at the restaurant, and he got to sell his prosciutto. I mean, he sold his, you know, plate of prosciutto for $10, and I mean, he must have sold hundreds of them. So it was awesome. We did really well, and the prosciutto was, I mean, it was amazing. It just had so much going on, and the texture was perfect, and it was just
that must have
delish.
Made you feel unbelievable.
Yeah, I felt great.
Huge accomplishment.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I got a really.
We need to open that
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. Questions. This gentleman here, wait for the microphone, please.
What fraction of your own food do you grow?
Well, you know, if I actually did something in the book, and I sometimes do this, which is like I try to survive on the farm only, and I'm able to do it, but I lose weight. And what I realized in the end after trying to be sort of like totally self-sufficient is that self-sufficiency is a ruse. Like you're just – what happens is you can't share with people. And so it made me kind of a meaner person. You know, I could meaner. So I couldn't like share with my neighbors. I would be like, hey, I need to eat that beet tomorrow. You know, I mean, everything, you know, is accounted for in this way. And so I think that's a real problem with the whole like self-reliance thing and like doomsday thing is like, you know, that it's only enough food for you. We need everybody to be growing food, you know, and we need to share resources and help each other instead of like trying to do that. The other thing I realized is like, I live in an urban environment, you know, I could grow and eat only lettuce and beets, you know, forever, but I love Chinese food, you know, and that's part of the reason why I live in an urban area. And so it's not a goal for me, but if I wanted to, I probably could grow, probably not 100%, probably 80%. But as it is now, I probably maybe only 30%. Yeah.
Sarah.
You said that you're working as well. Mm-hmm. What do you do? Job-wise?
Well, I'm a journalist. I am a writer, and then I sell biodiesel. I have a biodiesel filling station in Berkeley with some friends.
In terms of dedicating your time to work and your farm, how much time are you devoting to the farm?
Well, I mean, the farm is really, it's one of those things that I can't even quantify. It's kind of like, I don't know, how much time do you spend brushing your teeth or something? It's just like part of my life. I never am like accounting for it. But people ask me so much, so I started to think about it more.
Is it like having a massive quantity of pets?
Yeah, it's like, I guess, like if you had a massive quantity of pets, it's a couple hours in the morning, and there's always like foraging trips. I'm always like either dumpster diving, or my new thing with the goats is I go around and I cut suckers off trees because they love branches more than anything. So I'll go do that. But I mean, for me, it's like this weird, it's like a meditation, or it's just part of life. It's not something that I can account for. But I probably work about, I don't know, maybe 30 hours a week or something. Normal. Yeah, like I have a normal life, and then I have the farm to take care of too. I mean, it's like, but that's like rural farmers. Most rural farmers have another job too, so. Yep.
Next? Is there a next? No questions?
Yeah, no, that lady right there.
Hi. I don't really have a question as such, but I've got a different reaction hearing you today than I would have had 3 weeks ago, because about 3 weeks ago, one of my neighbors got a rooster. And I'm not a racist. I've got no idea what my city audiences are.
But I
know is it's pretty relentless, and it starts at 5 o'clock every morning. So, you know,
oh, only 5 o'clock.
Well, that's when I wake up and listen to it. Yeah. So there is another point of view. I mean, you know, urban farming, I agree, sounds great.
Totally.
As a passive listener, I'm getting a bit tired.
Yeah. No, roosters are for eating. I had a rooster. I had a couple roosters, and it's just... there's no way. They crow they don't even start crowing at 5. They crow at 3 in the morning and 4 and 3:30. You know, it just goes on and on and on and on. And we had these roosters once, because, you know, what happens is you get a straight run of chickens. It's like this the cheapest order that you can make. And it's like half of them are roosters. And so my rule is if they crow, they die. So that's it. Coco Vaughn, here we come. And that's great. Like, that's part of the whole thing, right? And some people like it. You know, we had our downstairs neighbor, Mr. Nguyen from Vietnam. He would be like, I love it when the rooster sings. And Bill is like, kill that fucker, you know, like. So I hear you. I hear you. I would just put a recipe under the door.
Right? That's so perfect.
Yeah. But no, seriously, I'd go talk to the neighbors, because really what I hate is when people are just like, they don't like something and then they complain about it and then they see you and there's like weird tension. And what I love about my neighbors is they're always like, hey, your pigs stink. And I'm like, oh, okay, thanks. You know, I'll get rid of them. And so I like that dialogue, because, you know, everybody, it's great to talk to your neighbors. And this is the great thing about urban farming, is that then it opens up this thing where like you can go talk to your neighbor and you don't have to be like, hey, you know, you can talk to them and then be like, wow, what's up with the rooster, you know? So I think there's a way to do it in diplomatic, you know, terms. But I hear you.
Right here, this lady right here.
Hi, I just have a couple of questions. So who owns the land? And also, what do you do about water?
Oh, yeah, good questions. Who owns the land? Well, it was owned by this guy, and he would come to the garden every once in a while, and he would always be like, what the hell is going on? And he was a developer, so he bought the land to develop it into condos. And so he was always, like, threatening me. He would be like, the bulldozers are going to come, and I'm going to build these condos. But the thing is that then I would call the permitting office, because, you know, they have to put that yellow permit up that says, like, we're going to build. And they would always be like, oh, my God, that guy's crazy. There's no way someone's going to give permitting for that, because it was a crazy idea. So then he actually ended up selling the lot. At the end of the book, it ends with the lot going up for sale, and I'm just like, crap. He ended up selling it to this woman named Shirley. And Shirley showed up one day, and she's like, hey, and this is so funny when these things happen, because I like almost puke. You know, she's like, hey, whose garden is this? I'm like, mine. And then she's like, because I just bought the lot. And then I'm like, oh, do you want me to move it? And then she's like, no, just plant some flowers, and I'm going to develop it eventually, but you're fine. And this was right during the housing boom, and now that it's the bust has happened, so I've been lucky. Yeah, I love the recession.
All foreclosed houses should become urban farms.
The recession has affected the dumpsters. The dumpsters are not as good as they used to be. Just a fun fact. And then the water actually is paid. Our landlord pays for it, and it can be in the summer months. It's pretty bad, and so we started doing gray water, which is like you reuse your washing machine and sink and bathtub water, and that's been really effective for watering the trees. And then we just conserve a lot of water. And that's why I have a composting. I have like a, I don't think you saw the outhouse. We have an outhouse now.
No, I didn't see the outhouse.
Because I'm like, I'm not pooping in clean water that could water my garden. That makes no sense. So it gets you thinking about water and how we use it in these bizarre ways.
So do you have a composting toilet?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Does it work well?
It's an outhouse is what it is. It sounds fancy, a composting toilet. It's like an outhouse. It's like this barrel, and then you... Why am I talking about this right now?
I don't know. You're compelled to share.
No, it's horrible. He's horrified. He's like, if I was her neighbor, I'd die.
Thank you so much for your talk. Since you brought up the composting toilet.
Right.
Is there a use for it in the garden?
Yeah. Well, basically what you have to do, World Health Organization, is you have to let it sit for 2 years. So before you can actually use it. And so, you know, that means you're going to have a lot of these, like, buckets and stuff full of stuff. But what I do is you plant a tree in your poo. So, and it takes a while, believe me, to fill up a, because I'm the only person in my whole house who does it. Like, Bill refuses to use the outhouse. I'm like a lonely shitter. It's sad. Except I actually get to go out with the goats, so I'll be like out there and the goats will be like looking at me like, what is she doing? But so not so lonely. But basically what I've decided to do is that I'm going to plant trees. So I have these, like, they're basically like 35-gallon buckets. And then you can plant a tree, like a banana tree, something that really likes a lot of nitrogen. And then it grows for a couple years. And then it's, you know, then when you're ready to plant it, you can just take it out, plant it, and then use the dirt, which is now dirt. So, but some people I've heard just like wait a year. Some people use worms, like vermicompost, and that turns it over a lot faster. So
you can vermicompost your pet waste.
Cool, of course.
But you have to keep, but it has to be a completely separate worm bin from your house kitchen waste.
Makes sense.
But yes, you can use it for your dog and kitty poo.
That's so cool.
But you can't use can't be the scoopable kind of cat litter. Way in the back.
Mother's in heaven. On a hot day, if you're wearing your bathing suit.
No, no, no.
On a hot day, if you're wearing your bathing suit, why don't you discreetly shower with your vegetables? Is that?
Oh yeah, I know. I wish I could do that.
Not
I don't know.
Do you really want to be that open in your neighborhood?
It's pretty open. Like, it's very open.
Yeah.
Yeah. It might be bad. I think I would get a lot of attention. There's
unwanted attention.
There's like prostitutes in my neighborhood. You know what I mean? Like people. I wouldn't want to like compete. So that's all I'm saying. but yeah, no, I've thought of an outdoor shower, and that's a major motivation for me to actually get my own piece of land, like my ghetto farm. And then I can just like outdoor shower. There's nothing better than an outdoor shower. I do agree. It's really awesome. Yeah.
Right here.
Does Bill help in the garden, and has this been a strain on your relationship?
Bill, you know what Bill is he is love scrounging. Like that's just what he likes to do. And so it's a really great relationship. And like for us, a hot date is like we go to the movies and then we're like, let's go dumpster diving, you know? And so that's just kind of what we do. So that's good that he does that. And then he waters the garden and he does like these farming experiments. Cause you know, I know how to actually raise vegetables and stuff. And he just tries to do things like grow potatoes in sacks and, you know, which works. I mean, sometimes he's really successful and then I learn. So he's like a dabbler and he is into it. I do most of the animal stuff. After the pigs, I think he just got really burnt out. And so I do most of the caretaking for the goats and the rabbits.
I was just curious, what are some of your future plans for Ghost Town Farm? Because you've gotten a lot so far. I'm just wondering what else you got planned.
Yeah. I am still into commandeering that play field. I mean, I think I could do sheep, and it would be so cool, because then they wouldn't have to mow the lawn. You know what I'm saying? I also have fantasies of a mule, and just because, like, that would be so rad to, like, ride my mule through Oakland. And then sometimes, like... Well, I mean, like, think about the police. Like, I was in New York the other day, and I was like, there's, like, mounted policemen in New York, you know? So how crazy. It wouldn't be that weird to just be, like, on a mule in Oakland. Plus, who would stop me? Nobody. So that's something. I'm actually, like, in a little bit of a holding pattern right now. I feel like it's really a great system. I have these chickens for eggs. I have the rabbits for meat. I have the goats for milk. And so, and all of their manure goes into the garden or is composted. And so it's, like, this nice cycle. And I think what happens is, I mean, I'm kind of interested in trying Muscovy ducks, which are these, like, silent ducks that are really delicious and really big. And so I'm kind of thinking about dabbling with them. But right now I've actually, like, one of the things I've learned is, like, it's nice to actually just maintain what you have, you know, just in a holding pattern. I've actually started raising rabbits with better fur, working with their genetics to have make better fur rabbits. So that's one thing. Some of the fur can be, depending on your breed, the fur will be, like, kind of feel cheap and like a bad 80s rabbit fur coat thing, but there are rabbits that have like almost mink-like fur, so I've been raising rabbits like that now.
If you were to do the ducks, would you have to create a pond?
Yeah. Well, yeah, they need a small pond. I've raised ducks before, and I just would do like a wash tub sunk into into the earth, and that was enough of a thing. But yeah, they like to bathe and preen and that kind of thing.
What do you do with the fur currently?
Well, it just sits in my living room, and I just fantasize about what I'm going to make with it. I'm like, bikini top.
You need a seamstress now.
Yeah, I need a seamstress. But that's my problem, is I am not crafty. I have zero craft skills at all, so that's a problem.
But you're like in a hotbed of craft.
I know.
Okay, right here.
Hi, Novella. I was just sitting here tickled pink because I would love it if you moved into my neighborhood. It would totally piss my neighbors off.
I know.
And I would love that. Yeah. Also, I was thinking I wanted to get those tiny little ponies and have them. Oh, yeah. But I hear they're vicious. They're not very...
They are cute. But maybe not so useful. But maybe they would turn... You'd use their poo. Yeah, they'd be cute. They would be really cute. Yeah, I mean, I often think about moving to, like, if I ever moved to a nicer neighborhood, I would just be burned at the stake. It would be horrible.
For sure. Yeah. At least.
I remember I was like, Evan, am I gentrifying this neighborhood? Because I was, like, worried. And she's like, hell no. Like, look, the hell are you talking about? Like, I was like, oh,
layer,
yeah.
A very complex layer of funk.
And you're right, the white trash thing is totally spot on.
I was curious about the goat milk and the goat cheese. Is that something that, you know, you could do in an apartment, or did you have to take it somewhere else? Or?
Well, the goats, I actually, they're in the backyard where the pigs used to be. And they, what's great about the goats is they love, and it's lucky that I live in the upstairs apartment of the duplex. And so our goats run up and down the stairs, and they get tons of exercise. And that's great for them because they love to climb things. That's their nature. And I milk the goats in my laundry room, so I bring them up in the stairs, up the stairs, and I have this, everything's, like, very, like, cramped in my apartment. It's not a big apartment, so I have this, like, goat stanchion right next to the washing machine, and I just load the goat up and just milk the goat. And
do you milk it by hand?
Mm-hmm, yeah, hand milk. And they're Nigerian dwarf goats, so it's like I basically use my thumbs. Like, they have really small udders. I remember being like, oh my God, how do I do this? And when I first got the goats, people are always like, I want to get a goat. And I'm always like, don't get a goat. It's like, you need two goats at least. And they're a lot of work. Like, it's like having like a child in a way, except the child sleeps outside in a pen, which could work. So
how much milk do they get?
Well, basically, my one goat gives about a quart of milking. So it actually adds up. That's a lot of milk over time. And so I make cheese and yogurt and stuff like that. And I never pasteurize it because I'm just like, whatever. It seems fine. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I just want to say thank you so much to Novella for not...
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.